Hi, everyone. This is Rachel Fowler with the U.S. Human Rights Network, and we're happy to have everyone join us today for our first quarterly member call for 2015. We're really excited about the members that we have that will be sharing today, and appreciate the folks that have reached out to get in the queue to share about their exciting work, events, and resources. The first part of the call, we have some speakers scheduled that will talk a little bit about the CAT review in November, intersectionality, the right to water, reproductive rights, and getting involved in the International Decade of People for People of African Descent. My colleague, Yolande Tomlinson, is going to help out today, and she will be giving instructions for people in terms of raising your hands, muting your phones as we try to go through the agenda. So, again, welcome, everyone. I see people are dialing in as we start. And with that, Yolande, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks, Rachel, and welcome, everyone. So to get started, I'm going to ask all of our speakers who are under the updates for members, specifically Monica James, Rebecca Landy, Tondabantu Iverson, Rob Robinson, Diana Lugo, and Dawodi Desir, to press star one. That will enter you into a queue where we can easily mute and unmute you as we go through the agenda. And at the end of the Q&A that will follow this session, I'm going to ask you to press the pound key, and that will then take you out of the queue. So thank you, Dawodi, Tinjiwe, I see you, Rob, Diana, and Tondabantu. If Rebecca is also in the line, could you also press star one, as well as Monica James? So I don't yet see Monica or Rachel, so.
Yeah. So what we may do, I think we're going to have to change the order, Yolande, and we'll start with you and Tondabantu.
Okay. So, Tondabantu, I've unmuted your line.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right, good morning to everyone, and good afternoon to those to whom it applies. let me just first of all express my appreciation to HMDK and all the members of the U.S. Human Rights Network staff for the opportunity to say a few words of support and encouragement for our collective efforts to become more intentional about making our human rights movement building work more intersectional. I think in our day-to-day and weekly efforts to oppose human rights violations, we can sometimes forget that the U.S. Human Rights Network was actually born out of the efforts of feminists of color and their allies who met in 1999 at Mill Valley, California, to figure out how to build human rights movements that would not continue to silence their experiences of oppression and continue to render them invisible. Their intent was to be guided by an intersectional framework, which was evolving at that time, to create human rights movements that would be guided by the recognition that all forms of oppression must be ended. That Mill Valley meeting was followed upon by a second meeting shortly thereafter at Howard University. And the broad, intersectional, and grassroots approach of our network took root. The tragedies, challenges, struggles, and victories of the past year have underscored the fact that we are living through a time of enormous potential. Across this country, many of us as oppressed people and communities are gaining in consciousness of the need for social movements to respect, protect, and fulfill our human rights. Yet as this consciousness grows and continues to take organizational forms, giving expression to our human needs and also helping us to challenge institutional policies and structures, we are also becoming aware of weaknesses that must be overcome. One of the most insidious of these problems is the tendency for social change agents to become so focused on injustices or human rights violations with which we are most familiar, or that seem to result from a single issue or type of oppression, that we fail to understand how we miss opportunities to strengthen human rights movement by supporting the human rights needs and struggles of other individuals and groups. Because all of our human rights violations are systemically linked and intersect in complicated ways, we must become more vigilant about learning how to fight for our rights in terms in opposition to human rights violations. Excuse me. Unless we become more intentional about the intersectional nature of our oppressions and discriminations, we will unwittingly miss opportunities to consistently build solidarity in our movements, and instead we will inevitably act in ways that actually reproduce the pains and abuses and grievances for others with whom we should be supporting. And we've experienced some of this during the past year. And one of the ways that I think is most dangerous when we encounter this kind of problem is when we feel that we're forced to compete for limited resources. During the past year, we have found ourselves having to address this in a number of cases, which I don't see the need to go into in particular now, but I would like to underscore the need that we have seen, and some of us have committed ourselves to working more conscientiously to strengthen our organizational understanding of intersectionality and our organizational approaches to working more conscientiously with one another to strengthen our problem-solving capacities. We want to become more intentional about how we can all work so that we can find procedures and processes and steps and policies in our work so that we can get through the difficulties that we find ourselves in when competition seems more important than support for one another and solidarity. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tunde Bantu, for beautifully laying out, you know, sort of what intersectionality is as a concept and how that becomes useful for us as members of a collective trying to work towards collective liberation. So to follow up on that, I want to talk about what the Network Coordinating Center is doing with regard to intersectionality. Specifically, we have convened a working group on intersectionality, solidarity, and self-determination. To add to some of the goals that you've laid out, the goals include modeling and promoting intersectionality within our network and the human rights movement more broadly, to forge stronger relationships among network members by promoting and working together in an intersectional way, to create accessible and engaging resources on intersectionality, and to promote and model conversations and solidarity and self-determination as critical elements of an intersectional approach. One of the specific projects that the group is engaged in doing right now is on hosting a conversation series on solidarity. As we know, intersectionality says that our solutions and our strategies to combat human rights violations and the multiple forms of oppression that we experience as people with multiple identities, these solutions must overlap and connect. So, working across issue silos, building cross-issue alliance, and working in solidarity are critical components of doing intersectional work, hence the need for these conversations and these models to exist. So we see these conversations as opportunities for members to have difficult but necessary conversations with the goal to find ways to build our collective liberation. We want them to reflect our experiences, our challenges, and aspirations, and so want to hear what topics and issues are of interest to you as members and partners of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Just in terms of how the conversations will work, the conversations will be hosted one per month starting in February. Each one will be hosted by a different member of the working group, and the format and the content, as I said, will be up to the working group member and you, our membership. So please look for a call to submit topics and issues to structure those conversations. We welcome everyone to participate in each conversation as there will be different topics each month. And as well, look out for a calendar announcing the dates, but not the topics of the conversation. We're planning to have the conversations end in a larger member conversation during the biannual conference. That will be December, if you missed the announcement that went out earlier this week in Austin, Texas. And finally, just in terms of the larger group itself, we're looking to expand the membership of the group. We currently have 6 members on the group, and we want to expand to include 3 or 4 more members. So in the coming week, look out for a call for applications. The announcement will outline in detail the commitment we're asking group members to make, what gaps in issues and constituencies we're looking to fill on the current group, and what skill sets we're looking for to round out the group. So if you have questions about what Tanda Bantu has said in terms of, you know, intersectionality and solidarity and why it's important, as well as the group and what we plan to do, I'll be happy to take your questions during the Q&A session.
Thank you, Yolande and Tanda Bantu. And just to follow up on what Yolande said, we're going to hold the Q&A session until the speakers have presented. So we'll take a break between the first part of the call and have a Q&A before we move into member sharing for the last part. So thank you both for that overview. I think it actually worked out well that we did that first. I'm going to turn to my colleague, Rebecca Landy, to provide an update on our international mechanisms work and how it is strengthening member and partners' activism and advocacy here in the U.S. And Rebecca is going to talk about the CAT review that we were a part of in November of last year. So, Rebecca, I'll turn it over to you.
And Rebecca, if you're on the line, press *1 to be entered into the queue so we can mute and unmute you. Again, that's *1. I don't see Rebecca.
Yolande, you can unmute Tenjiwe.
Okay. We'll do.
Hi, can you all hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thanks, Rachel, and thank you, Yolande, and thank you, everyone, for being on the call today. So as Rachel mentioned, our most recent international mechanism review that the network was helping to coordinate was under the Convention Against Torture this past November. So the network helped coordinate a delegation of about 70 civil society representatives who came with us to Geneva, Switzerland for the review that took place on November 12th and 13th. And it was a variety of organizations and groups that submitted reports. There were 43 civil society reports that were submitted through the network, and I think a total of around 70 civil society reports submitted altogether. And the review, in addition to some civil society advocates, we also had some other folks that joined us, including the parents of Michael Brown, the brother of Rakia Boyd, a woman who experienced sexual violence in the military, people who have been in the juvenile justice system. So there were a variety of issues that advocates, people talking about police violence, in particular some folks in Chicago, and hopefully one of the advocates from Chicago that was working on trans violence against the transgender community will be able to join us to talk about her experience. But the delegation was really exciting, and there was a lot of youth and people who hadn't been before to Geneva. And after the review, in early November, the concluding observations came out November 28th. And within those concluding observations, there were a list of issues, 4 issues that the U.S. will be reviewed on and have to submit a follow-up report within 1 year, so next November. So one thing that the coordinating center is doing is making sure that folks have the opportunity to take part in those follow-up mechanisms on those one-year review issues. Civil society will be able to submit shadow reports again. So, for example, the ICCPR review, which took place last March, We'll be holding a webinar shortly in February. Look out for that information for folks to submit shadow reports on those four issues. So that's just a little bit of information about CAT and what happened there. We may be opening up the Convention Against Torture Task Force to a few more people who are interested, so look out for that. And if you have any questions, you can email me at cat@ushrnetwork.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebecca, for that. And hopefully Monica will be able to call in and we'll move her around in the agenda if she's able to. So we'll move forward now and talk about advocating for the right to water. Rob Robinson with NESRI will share about the work ongoing around water in Detroit and West Virginia and some other areas of the country and plans for collaboration across the country on that work. Rob?
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you to everybody at the network for inviting me. Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be across the country. My name is Rob Robinson, and I am based here in New York City with an organization called NESRI, the National Economic and Human Rights Initiative. I've been blessed to work with folks on the ground in Detroit, and particularly Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, from some longstanding relationships through the U.S. Social Forum National Planning Committee, some of the work I was involved with to take back the land, et cetera. In June, I visited Detroit for the Allied Media Conference and met with Michigan Welfare Rights Organization. And it was incredible how they dropped a documentary on the table in front of me that NESRI produced back in 2009 called More Than a Roof. It documented the official visit, first official mission of a UN special rapporteur to the United States. And they simply asked me, how can we do something like this in Detroit? And their issue was the human right to water. Water shutoffs were hitting record numbers in Detroit. And folks were not getting access to water, something we need for our very survival in day-to-day lives. And it started with a letter-writing campaign to Geneva and the Human Rights Commission there in Geneva. And lo and behold, two special rapporteurs visited Detroit in October, Katerina de Albuquerque, the rapporteur on the right to water, safe drinking water and sanitation, and Leilani Farhar, the recently appointed rapporteur on the right to adequate housing. From that, we learned of a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit that is being pushed against the federal government, and four plaintiffs in Detroit are suing the federal government in the city of Detroit for lack of access to water. Recently, one of those plaintiffs in that lawsuit, Miss Nicole Cannon, passed away. She was a woman whose water was shut off, single mom of three children, and she was living with a severe lung disease for a long time, and obviously this had its toll and took an effect on her, and she lost her life. So it sort of ramped up the organizing on the ground. From that mission in October, we have been talking to folks in West Virginia. I was in West Virginia in Appalachia area working with the Direct Action Welfare Group and the Assembly to End Poverty, which contains members of Michigan Welfare Rights and Direct Action Welfare Group in West Virginia, plus other folks who were working on anti-poverty efforts around the country. And we started to have some initial conversations on what the human right to water might look like. The network has since reached out and engaged a lot of these folks, and we are looking forward to moving this process forward. Also connecting with folks who recently went through a chemical spill in Montana, and they don't have access to safe drinking water. Portland, Oregon is having problems accessing water, and we just recently learned that there are problems in Ohio. So I think there's a groundswell of activity in the grassroots community, and folks are willing to work on the human right to water and kind of put together a convening of what this really means. Rebecca Landy has been helping us in sort of organizing these efforts. And the week of February 9th, Rebecca will be bringing together groups and organizers and grassroots communities from around the country to engage in a dialogue. If you're interested in joining that group, you can email Rebecca at rlandy@ushrn, or excuse me, rlandy, that's L-A-N-D-Y, at ushrnetwork.org. Rebecca will put you on that list, and hopefully we will get folks together to start to figure out what this looks like. There are some other efforts being convened by other groups, and we hope to connect with some of those groups around this issue of a right to water, but it does look like folks are really on the ground excited about this opportunity, and I'm personally excited that the network is taking this on as work. Very much would like to connect groups across the country that I've been working with personally, along with other folks, and bring them into the fold and have a bigger discussion. So I'll be around at the end of the phone call if folks have specific questions about the information I just put out. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. That was excellent, and kudos to you and the others that are engaged in this work. It's exciting to see what's happening, and it's exciting to see the collaboration between the communities and the different states. So now we're going to move along in the agenda, and I'm going to call on Diana Lugo Martinez, and if you'll introduce your organization and its work, Diana. She's going to talk with us about efforts to protect reproductive rights here in the U.S., specifically in Texas.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon to everyone. Thank you to the U.S. Human Rights Network for inviting us to speak today about the Nuestro Texas hearing. My name is Diana Lugo Martinez, and I am the Senior Director of Community Engagement Programs for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. I'd like to take the opportunity today to speak very specifically about a collaborative effort that we are currently launching in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. And it is entitled Nuestra Voz, Nuestra Salud, Nuestro Texas, a women's human rights hearing. It's being hosted by the Center for Reproductive Rights, the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, and the U.S. Human Rights Network. And it's set to be held in the Valley of Texas on March 9th. Before I go into more details about the actual hearing, I'd like to provide some background on the human rights crisis in the Rio Grande Valley with regards to access to reproductive health services. Recent actions by Texas legislature have targeted access to and affordability of reproductive health services in Texas. So notable policies that have done this include the slashing of state funding for family planning services by two-thirds, placing ideologically motivated restrictions on reproductive health providers, and imposing the country's most extreme package of abortion restrictions. For decades, family planning clinics in rural communities provided preventative women's health services to low-income, uninsured immigrant women. But when the Texas legislature cut its state funding for women's health by two-thirds in 2011, the impact on the Valley, an area already suffering from a shortage of reproductive health care providers, was immediate and severe. We had 9 clinics close in a period of 1 year, and dozens of others had to reduce hours or raise fees. As documented in our Nuestro Texas Human Rights Report that was released last year, women unable to get preventive care experienced a rise in unintended pregnancy, pain from chronic and life-threatening health conditions, and fear that conditions like cervical and breast cancer are progressing undiagnosed. Then in 2013, the Texas legislature compounded the crisis in access by passing the nation's most extreme anti-abortion legislation. As of November 2014, the enforcement of this law has resulted in the closure of half the state's abortion clinics. The one provider in the Valley has closed twice temporarily, and in those instances left women without access to a provider for 250 miles. And I'd also like to note that for some of our undocumented community members in the Valley, that meant that abortion services were out of reach, given that there is a checkpoint from the Valley to San Antonio that some community members would not be able to cross. So that being said, the human rights hearing, our desire is that the human rights hearing will expose the impact of these policies on the health and human rights of a population that already faces multiple forms of discrimination and oppression on the basis of gender, ethnicity, immigration status, poverty, and geography. So given this, the goal is to provide a highly visible and timely mechanism to spotlight the human rights impact of Texas's reproductive health policy on Latinas and immigrant women living on the border who face disproportionate barriers to health care due to poverty, again, lack of citizenship status, and border-related violence. The hearing will serve as an opportunity for women most affected by the funding cuts and abortion restrictions in the Valley to testify about their experiences and to build and strengthen connections among Texas movements around immigrant rights, the labor movement, and ending violence against women. After the hearing, we will also produce an outcome document to build off of the Metro Texas report with a detailed analysis of human rights violations. I'd also like to note that the hearing is taking place in March, given the Texas legislative, it'll be in the middle of the Texas legislative session, and the timing of the Universal Periodic Review. It's being held on March 9th to commemorate International Women's Day, and therefore leading up to the hearing on International Women's Day on the 8th, we'll be hosting a rally and a march on International Women's Day, which will be a solidarity march with those taking place nationally, statewide, nationally, and internationally. And that's being coordinated by the NLIRH Texas Latina Advocacy Network and the Human Rights Council of South Texas, the Human Rights Coalition of South Texas. And I'd just like to note that that coalition formed after the Nuestro Texas report and being able to lift up and use the human rights analysis to frame the crisis taking place in the Valley and the intersectionality of all of the issues at play. And then also there will be a Human Rights 101 training that has been developed by the U.S. Human Rights Network taking place just before the hearing. So there's a lot going on in the Valley in the coming months and to prep for it, and also then during the two-day event, and we're quite excited about this opportunity and the hearing. A number of community members, researchers, and providers are participating in all of the events and are already set to provide their testimony. And in speaking with our team in Texas, they've noted that the community in the Rio Grande Valley is eager to tell their stories, demand their rights, and truly hold the government accountable. This is a fantastic opportunity for women and community members that may otherwise not be able to travel or have found their voice to be able to give voice to their lived experiences and again, hold the necessary parties accountable. So thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you today, and to the U.S. Human Rights Network for partnering with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health and the Center for Reproductive Rights on this initiative. We look forward to being able to present again in the very near future on the results.
Thank you, Diana, for that presentation on what you're doing. That was an excellent overview. And Yolande mentioned that the network will be holding the biennial conference, our national biennial conference, in December in Texas this year. So we'll, it'll be another opportunity to try to amplify the voices there in the Valley and other parts of the state. So with that, we're going to move to the last presenter for this part of the call, and then we'll have some time for questions and answers. So start thinking about questions and answers you may have. And I'm going to ask Dewoti Desir to share with us about the work of the U.S. Human Rights Network member-initiated action team that is organizing activities and work around the International Decade for People of African Descent. And, Yolande, I'm going to ask you to unmute Stephanie as well in the event she, wants to also report out with Dewoti.
Hello?
We can hear
you. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for this opportunity to speak. Good day to everyone, and honor and respect to everyone. Again, my name is Zoe Tidizia. I'm the founder and president of the DDPA Watch Group, and now the new interim chair of the UN Subcommittee for the Elimination of Racism, Xenophobia, and Other Forms of Intolerance. We're based in New York. The DDPA Watch Group is in a MIA partnership with Stephanie Franklin of the Franklin Law Group, PC. We have, again, created a MIAT entitled the Ubuntu Council. Now, the focus of the council is tied to the UN International Decade for People of African Descent, which has become effective January 1st, 2015 to December 31st, 2024. And the objective of the decade is, in fact, an intersectional and multi-sector approach to the promotion and protection of human rights of people of African descent, and it's a priority of the United Nations. So far, our MIA partnership, the Ubuntu Council, has created a website. We had it built and launched on January 1st. We're going to be doing some of the following things to raise awareness about human rights challenges faced by African descendants. They include a tribunal against Afrophobia, with African-based spiritual systems at its core. We'll be doing advocacy for legislation that will alter the use of psychotropic drug use on our children, especially girls. We're going to be hosting an opening ceremony of the decade at a site of memory for African descendants. We'll be co-organizing, hopefully, an annual Sacred Seasons dialogue with the UN Subcommittee that I now chair. And we're trying to establish a leadership council that will help us establish our goals. To learn more about what we're doing, see the details, you can go to our website, which is www.thedecade.com. We also initiated a social media campaign on the Ubuntu Council Facebook page. The Facebook page was opened on December 2014. Now, it posts issues of concern to us, and it's going to list our events and the events of other organizations related to the International Decade and our various objectives, but it's also intended to encourage people to send us pictures of themselves, pouring libations, lighting candles, setting up altars, and other ritualistic activities to honor the ancestors. The spiritual aspect of the work that we're doing is very important and is meant to counter Afrophobia. We invite all of you to send your pictures to us as well. And again, the Facebook page is called the Ubuntu Council. One of the reasons that spirituality is playing such an important role in our work is because we can talk about human rights for African descendants until we're blue in the face. But until African thought and knowledge is devilified, until it's embraced, until it's acknowledged, we feel strongly that we're not going to be able to make any substantive breakthroughs. Because as long as, again, we're being vilified and demonized, there will be setbacks in the human rights movement. Now, the leadership team, that national leadership team that we're seeking to establish, we were also soliciting names, and we're asking that those of you who are on the phone who are interested in working with us, or if you think of people that should be working with us, to please send us an email at the at admin@thedecade.com, and I'm going to ask that you also CC the ddpa.watchgroup@gmail.com. So again, admin@thedecade.com and ddpa.watchgroup@gmail.com. We're again seeking names to create this national coalition to a national leadership team to help us meet our obligations. Stephanie and I have already already involved in a number of public presentations as part of our MIAT. For example, on the 7th, she's going to be attending the Remembering Ancestors Middle Passage ceremony in St. Augustine, Florida, to honor the ancestors. This occasion marks the 450th anniversary of the first and oldest permanent settlement of Europeans, Africans, and indigenous people in the U.S. And Stephanie has asked the organizers for a few minutes to talk about the work that we're doing. On December 10th, the Afro-Latino Presente 2015 is taking place in New York. So if anybody is in New York, it's the Madiba Image Studio at 46 West 116th Street. We're going to be introducing the history of the decade and the genesis of it and the guiding principles of the international decade, which are justice, recognition, and development. So I'll be presenting there and talking about our MIAN initiative and other activities. And finally, on February 21st, Stephanie has invited me to Baltimore to talk about my book, which focuses on monuments, memorials, and historic sites of the Maafa, or the transatlantic slave trade. The book is dedicated to the international decade, and its intent is, the event is intended to educate the public at large about geopolitics, space, history, and tie it into our MIAT activities. And finally, while it's still in its early stages, a town hall meeting on psychotropic drug use on black girls in foster care is being planned in March by Stephanie. This is one of the major goals of our MIAT initiative, to educate our communities about what is being done essentially to our daughters. And the date of location for this event will be announced in 2 weeks. So that is my update, and I want to thank you for your support and contributions towards realizing our goals. So we look forward to hearing from you by email.
And just very briefly, this is Stephanie. I just wanted to clarify that the webpage is thedecade.org. So
yes.
The .com is .org, and the email address is admin@thedecade.org. I just want the membership to know that this is a web page right now. We are developing a fuller website that will list all of the events, have galleries, a gallery page for pictures and things, but we're still working on development of the full site. And I think DeRodi covered everything. I did want to speak a little bit more about the Leadership Council. Regarding the Leadership Council, DeRodi and I will be looking for 7 to 10 persons to join the leadership team to help support the goals and further develop the goals and objectives for the decade. And so we have put together a questionnaire that we are still editing. And in the next 2 weeks or so, that should go out to the member listserv with the network and other places as well. And we'll be looking for people to join us in moving the decade forward and supporting our ancestors and people of African descent all over the globe. So thank you.
Thank you, DeRodi and Stephanie, for that update. We'll obviously make sure to send out the emails through the listserv for the questionnaire for the Leadership Council applicants. So we're going to take a few minutes for questions. I think we have about 5 to 6 minutes. So if you, Yolande, if you'll let folks know how to raise their hand to ask a question.
So all of the speakers who presented earlier have been unmuted, so if you're called on, you can speak. And if you have background noise, please mute your phone. I believe that's *6.
Yes.
And if you have a question that you would like to ask of our presenters, press *1, and then I'll recognize you in the queue to ask your question. Okay. So we have a question from J.R. Fleming. JR, go ahead with the question. JR?
Hello? Yeah. Well, I was calling to do the 2-minute presentation for the Land Housing and Action Group. I didn't know if,
We're going to do that in the next portion of the agenda. At this point, we're taking questions about what folks have reported out in the first part.
Okay, then. I'll wait.
Okay.
Thanks, JR.
Jasper, is your question for folks who've spoken, or this is about the next phase?
Hello, this is Jasper Jones from the UBCA Community Trust for Family Life Improvement and the 7,000 Villages in the Yaksa-Mission Republic. My question is ending the school-to-prison pipeline a part of the strategy that's being proposed?
And when you say strategy, what specifically are you referring to?
Every place in the United States, people of color are the majority in these urban areas. The schools are operating as a school-to-prison pipeline. So I was wondering if that's going to be a part of this strategy that's being proposed by the working group.
On intersectionality?
Yes.
Yes. So in terms of specific issues, we have not developed what those issues would be, but in terms of the larger concepts and issues that impact and lead to the school-to-prison pipeline, absolutely those will be part of the charge of the group as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's our lawsuit that we have filed with 7,000 Villages, and we unfortunately got the result that we did, which is a Dred Scott-type response from the Commonwealth Court System of Pennsylvania, which is basically refusal to provide performance of an enumerated right.
Thank you for sharing about that. And I'm sure we'll hear a little bit more about it in the next portion of the agenda. So if folks have questions, again, for our speakers, the thing to press is star one. That will enter into a queue. And if there are no further questions, then we can go ahead. So I see there's one more question. Pramilia, could you ask your question, please?
Hello?
Yes.
My name is Pramila Dixit Nag. I live in the Hudson Valley on a community-supported agriculture farm, organic. And I've been thinking a lot about the Human Rights Campaign and how to enter and join and be a participant. And I'm looking at this whole, the intention and the focus on integrating a lot of our movements. Recently, I was on a conference call on CEDAW, and there was an ambassador from El Salvador who was saying that with a focus on women's rights, what ends up happening is that all the issues become addressed because, of course, if you're violating rights to water or land or access to good food or housing, they all come under a woman's right to look after her family, and racial questions get addressed. And there is a mobilization, apparently, that's happening across the country to bring CEDAW laws at local municipal levels to mobilize for that. And I was wondering if they've approached the UN, U.S. Human Rights Network to coordinate so that we can indeed bring fracking and climate change and all of this under this one big umbrella.
Thank you so much for your comment. I'm going to let my colleague, Rebecca Landy, say briefly about the work that we're doing with the Cities for CEDAW campaign.
Yes.
Rebecca, you're unmuted.
Great. Thanks, Yolande, and thanks, Pramila, for your question and for bringing that to our attention. Yes, we've been on those coordinating calls as well, and locally here in New York, where one of the network's offices is based, we're working on the New York City Ordinance for Cities for CEDAW, our CEDAW ordinance, but I know that there are other communities that are working on ordinances as well, local, and we're part of that national network. And for folks that are interested in getting involved, we're happy to connect you with what's going on. But there was a national day just last week on January 20th, where cities, there was a virtual conference, and there were also events that took place across the country.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. We have two more questions, and then we're going to move to the next portion of the agenda. So, Rosalind Allison, if you go ahead and ask your question, you're unmuted.
Yes, I just have two questions. One, this is my first time on the call, so I wanted to know, and I live in Atlanta, and I wanted to know some of the initiatives, how to get more tangible with them here in Atlanta. I hear a lot of people from New York and different places, so how do I tangibly involve here to get to those people and to do the different things, especially when you talked about the gentleman about water, Mississippi, and, you know, having them, you know, drinking water and better, you know, efficiently.
So, Rosalind, I'll respond. This is Rachel. We can follow up with you offline. And because I'll have your phone number and email address and connect you with Rob and any of the other folks that you want to be connected with.
Okay.
So and then I'll also we can walk through some of the things on the website as well.
Okay. But, and the second
but we'll
question.
Go ahead.
I know you put some time on the decade. I wanted to know about the young girls' drugs in the, I think she said, the group home. What are they starting to do with that? Where are they located? I was trying to look at their website while we were on the phone. I wasn't sure where they were located or how to. Do I just send an email to you to be able to help with that initiative in here in Georgia or what?
Okay, so this is Stephanie Franklin.
The decade.
Mm-hmm. So this is Stephanie Franklin. I'm co-chair with Devotee Dazier. And I'm the president and CEO of the Franklin Law Group. And the piece about the over psychiatric drugging of black girls in foster care was an issue that I personally raised at the CERD Treaty Review in August of last year. And so the town hall meeting that I'll be hosting here is a town hall meeting here in Baltimore. I'm located in Baltimore, and I'll also hope to host these similar town halls all around the country in different cities. But you can reach me for specific information regarding that, and my email address is S like Stephanie Franklin, F-R-A-N-K-L-I-N, at franklinlaw.us. Also, our website is under construction and should be completed by the latter part of next week for more information about what we do at the Franklin Law Group. But specifically regarding that particular issue, you should contact me directly.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. And as Rosalind, if you want to contact any of our members and for anyone else on the call about things you've heard today, feel free to call contact the coordinating center, any of our staff members, and we'll be happy to put you in contact with folks. And our last question for the session is from Teresa. Teresa, did you have a question?
Yes. This is Teresa Elamine. My interest is in the decade for people of African descent. I remember when there was the year for people of African descent and not a lot happened. And I just want to clarify that you directed us to the ideas.org page. I've been on that trying to search. It seems like it's a company that helps people with digital issues. But I'm trying to find how this relates to the decade of for people of African descent. I'm sure I can get other questions answered later about that important initiative, but I'd just like to understand the website that I thought we were being directed to.
The
ideas.org.
Ideas.org.
Ideas.org. Yes. Did somebody say that?
No, ma'am.
No, no one said that. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. We can hear you.
Oh, yeah. No, we didn't refer to ideals.page. We referred to thedecade.org as the Ubuntu Council's page. There is more information at the UN's page on the International Decade. Now, if you have not found, you know, anything about, well, you made a note about during the International Year for People of African Descent, nothing happened. That's not quite true. Things did happen it mostly didn't happen in the United States because the U.S. has had a position since 2001 of boycotting the legal framework of the German Declaration and Program of Action Plan, which is what the International Year for People of African Descent came from, and from that, the International Decade. So one of the reasons why the Ubuntu Council has been set up is to help mobilize civil society around the issues of the decade, to help raise awareness about what's being done, and create various fora for people, for inviting people to participate and be engaged and make this a real decade, a decade where policies are created, where laws are enforced, where things actually happen to advance the social justice movement and human rights of African descendants. To that end, there is a UN working group of experts for people of African descent, and the offices of the High Commissioner of the for Human Rights, both in New York and in Geneva, are very much, again, about making this decade a priority. So the subcommittee that I am the chair of, the Subcommittee for the Elimination of Racism, Xenophobia, and Other Forms of Intolerance, is being counted on to help bring about these changes and to enable the objectives of justice, recognition, and development of the decade. And I'm going to take advantage of my position to create a partnership with the Ubuntu Council, again, as the MIA of the Human Rights, the U.S. Human Rights Network. And so hopefully that way our collective energies can come together on a national basis to really make a difference between 2015 and 2024.
Yeah, thank you for that. And Teresa, we'll connect you with Stephanie and Dewoti so you can follow up with them directly and make sure you get connected to the correct website. So I'm going to, at this point, move us to the next part of the meeting, and I want to thank all of the presenters for those excellent presentations. I think through the presentations, they demonstrated ways in which the intersectionality work and the conversations around solidarity will be helpful and necessary and useful over the coming year. I think we'll probably see more of that as we hear from different members about the work that they're engaged in. So if Nathaniel, I'm going to let Nathaniel report out first, if he is still on the phone.
So one second, Rachel. If all the speakers who presented in the first session could press the pound key, that will take you out of the queue. Thank you so much. And all the folks in the next session who will be speaking, so Boyette, Crystal, Nathaniel, Eric, Jasper, Marion, Nadia, Angelo, and Teresa, if you would press *1, that will put you in the queue, and then we can easily mute and unmute you. Thank you all so much. I see you lining up. So Pramila and Roslyn, if you were to press the pound sign, that would also take you out of the queue. Thank you both. Go ahead, Rachel.
Okay, thank you, Yolande. So Nathaniel had to jump off the phone, but he sent some notes that I can share with folks at the end of the report out. So let's start with Boyette Caparis, and I apologize for not pronouncing people's names correctly. I'm going to ask each presenter to, let us know about your organization and then, share with us the information that you want to share.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Boyette Caparis, representing the Alumni for International Human Rights Law. Our organization has been founded by graduates of Indiana University back in 2008. Right now, we have 81 members located, situated in the U.S. as well as various parts of the world. Our objective is to promote international and humanitarian law. We just published last Human Rights Day the inaugural issue of Praxis, our peer-reviewed journal, and this is our way of examining relevant and impact-oriented scholarships. We are interested in learning more and engaging our members in United Nations human rights reporting. And also, we would like to help and contribute to the current initiatives in training our mass membership on how to conduct human rights documentation, reporting, and oral intervention before the various United Nations human rights treaty bodies. That's it. I would like to give others a chance to also present. Thank you so much again, Rachel, and to the rest of the presenters. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Boyette, and we'll make sure to connect you with Rebecca and Tinjiwe after the call, because there will be a good connection for you with respect to your interest. So now if we can hear from Crystal Riley.
And Crystal, if you're on the line. I see you.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes.
Great. Thank you. So happy to be here today, and so thank you for this opportunity. I just wanted to say my first experience with the U.S. Human Rights Network was in November in Geneva for the review of the United States by the Committee Against Torture. One of the best parts of Geneva was the camaraderie and mutual support my two colleagues and I felt with the other NGOs and with the UHN, with the USHRN leaders and members. You said it would be exhilarating and exhausting, and it was. So thank you for that. Wanted to talk today about the National Consortium Torture Treatment Programs. We are a group of 36 programs across the country which provide mental health, medical, legal, and social services to refugees, asylum seekers, and asylees who have been tortured by foreign governments and now live in the United States. Tenets of the NCTTP's work are tiers: treatment, education, advocacy, research, and sustainability. We were founded in 1998. Today, I'm very pleased to tell you about the NCTTP's 7th Annual Research Symposium to be held Wednesday, March 4th in Washington, D.C., at the George Washington University, co-sponsored by the GW's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. We hope many of you can come, especially if you live close to the D.C. area. We're very excited about our two keynote speakers. The first one is the chair of the Committee Against Torture, Claudio Grossman. He's dean of the American University College of Law, and he will reflect on his work as chair for the Committee Against Torture. This is very timely as a follow-up to the CAT. Our second keynote speaker is Dr. David Kinsey. He founded the Intercultural Psychiatric Program in 1977 at the Oregon Health and Science University to provide care for refugees coming to Oregon from Southeast Asia following the Vietnam War. He currently treats torture survivors from Cambodia, Vietnam, Somalia, Ethiopia, and other African countries, and his talk will focus on the increasing evidence for the often strong consequences of torture and trauma in terms of emotional problems, mental illness such as PTSD and depression, and severe medical conditions such as hypertension and diabetes. We will also have 13 other presentations by NCTTP members who work in clinical, legal, or research capacities across the U.S. So we would love for you to help us spread the word about our symposium, and we welcome any suggestions for getting the word out. More information can be found on our website. Very simple, it's nctp.org. And if you go there, there's a place at the top to click on contact, and then you can send us an email for any more questions. I'm usually the first one to see that email or the second, so I'd be glad to answer any questions or if there's any questions if we have time now. The cost for the symposium is $50 to help us pay for the cost of the conference. Students are free. And again, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for helping us spread the word, we surely appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris, for that sharing. And now, Teresa El Amin with the Southern Anti-Racism Network is going to share about their conversations on race. So, Teresa?
Thank you. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay, because I have it on speakerphone, and sometimes there's some strange feedback. But my name is Teresa El Amin, and I'm with the Southern Anti-Racism Network, SARN, which originates from the Challenging White Supremacy Workshop online. It was a year-long conversation supported by Sharon Martinez, the originator of the Challenging White Supremacy Workshop, which she conducted in the Bay Area of California for many years. And at the end of that online workshop in 1998, several of us felt that we needed to be looking in people's faces and being in community with people to talk about challenging white supremacy. And we had our founding conference in 1999 at the historic Hollander Center in June 1999, where we formed the Southern Anti-Racism Network. So for these 15 years, we've been doing community organizing, mostly in North Carolina. And in 2010, we decided that we wanted to expand into South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama. So I moved from Durham, North Carolina, to Columbus, Georgia, which is right at the Alabama line. And we've been building the organization here in Columbus and in Alabama, and we do have some members in South Carolina. But our signature forum is a conversation on race. And thanks to the support of the Poverty, Race, and Research Action Council, we were able to conduct a serious conversation to kick off this series in February of 2012 with Chester Hartman, who is the research director. So the thing that has got us really going with the conversation is the reparations article by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic in June 2014, when we decided that that demand for reparations for African people worldwide is so important, we wanted to bring that conversation to the forefront again. So we held the conversation on race and reparations, supported by Akinyele Umojo at Georgia State University and William Darity at Duke University. And so so we've been holding these series of conversations in all of the injury areas, which we have been committed to dismantling racial disparities in the injury areas of criminal justice, economic inequality, education, environment, including housing, and health care. So in those five injury areas, we've been conducting these conversations. And right now, we're getting to conduct conversations February 19th and 24th in Columbus and Durham, respectively, on the conversation on race and economic inequality, because we really think that poverty is just such a hurdle to overcome, especially now when the gap is wider in terms of wealth and income than ever before. And so we will continue these conversations as we recruit members in the community who come to the conversation. We held a special conversation on law enforcement and community trust January 27th in Columbus, Georgia, and it was well attended and quite a few people signed up. So that's the kind of organizing, grassroots organizing, that we've been doing to build basis of support for ending white supremacy in all the areas where we have been able to organize. And I just want to say that North Carolina was a very, very special place, and Durham in particular, because through SARN we were able to pass the first anti-sweatshop ordinance in the South in Durham, North Carolina in 2000. And there are many other things that I would like to point to about Durham, North Carolina, but I would invite people to check out the archives and other information at our website, which is Project Sarn, S-A-R-N, ProjectSarn.org. And so you can find other information there. But I'm just so grateful to the U.S. Human Rights Network for calling on members to participate. And I'm just looking forward to continuing this work, particularly around the decade for people of African descent. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa, very much. It's exciting to hear all the good work that's going on in North Carolina and Georgia and South Carolina. We know that work is really needed, so thank you for that. Jasper Jones with 7,000 Villages, you spoke a little earlier, but I know that you want to share with us about your education justice case that you're working on. So, Jasper, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Before I speak, I say a little prayer. Some of the things I'm going to say are not the usual, so I ask God to give people ears to hear, eyes to see, and a heart to accept what I'm about to say. I am the person that wrote in 1978 the operational procedures for the enforcement of affirmative action that actually integrated the Fortune 1000, and I'm the federal program manager that was sent to try and stop the 1992 rebellion in South Central Los Angeles. So I have a lot of experience around the law, and the reason that my background, which also includes being a Cherokee American, allows me to pursue these issues using the law is that I know, unlike most people, the actual United States Constitution is a translation into English of the protocols of the American, of the Iroquois Confederation by the founding fathers of the United States of America, which was a government in rebellion against the crown. And what we actually are facing since the War of 1812 is a struggle against their agents who've been conducting a war of subversion against the sovereign citizens of America. You see, the law is the answer. If you can get the Constitution enforced, which our lawsuit efforts have shown, as we got a state representative who people voted against because of the problem of the school-to-prison pipeline in Philadelphia, which is the same problem all over the country where people of color are the majority in these urban areas, which is an actual plan, destruction of our people by agents of the crown. And people call them the one percenters, as I've been told. But this is actually an organized conspiracy against the people of America. I point this out because the representative put together a brief that he discussed in one of our neighborhood newspapers that showed that the closing of the schools by the school district was an unlawful activity, that a grand jury action should be taken against all officials involved in it. People don't realize that under the Constitution, the citizens are the sovereign and the government officials are under them in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And education is needed. So our group, the 7,000 Villagers, is actually conducting a campaign going into churches and going into community groups and any forum like this where we are inviting people to work with us to educate people on the true nature of the Constitution and how it can be used, the law can be used to liberate us from the tyranny of those who are actually carrying out the new chattel slavery, which we see being a government product through the unconstitutional drug laws and other things which have turned our school system all across the country into a school-to-prison pipeline operation as opposed to a school-to-work operation. In Pennsylvania, the Constitution actually has in it language that requires the schools to provide a thorough and efficient education that meets the needs of people in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. But clearly, when the schools are spending $3 billion a year in the city of Philadelphia, for example, and we're getting only 4% of the students proficient in reading and writing and computer and other skills, what's happening with the money? Fraud is occurring. So our lawsuit, which normally would have been approved for relief because the government organization is committing per se violations of state and federal law with regards to various categories of students, especially special needs students, because we ask for a forensic audit, which is the only way you can resolve these lawless activities with regard to the operation of schools around the country, forensic arts allow you to indict people for fraud. And basically, since Lincoln, when you use federal money and someone doing a follow-up review determines that the way that you spent the money, no way could the appropriation objective be achieved, you've committed a crime. And basically, our forensic audit request was a request to begin restructuring the schools, which there is no excuse for no person in America to not receive a thorough and efficient education, as we have the resources and the educational technology to educate everybody. The reason that it's not people are not being educated is because it's an organized conspiracy to put them into slavery. This concept, as I found going around the country, people did not have these concepts because they were miseducated. But we, as a people, American citizens of all stripes, do have the right to take the elected officials to task and to court when they violate our rights. And we do have this, a right to happiness and economic and social justice and environmental justice. All justices existed in this country prior to the colonization period. To clarify that so people have a concrete concept to stand on, before the Europeans came in 1492, there was trade between the various Africa and Europe. And when they arrived in 1492, there were no taxes, no prisons, no pollution, and no poverty in this part of the world to speak of. Now, we have a multitude of these things, as we've been talking about on this conference call. So there's a need to organize people to enforce the Constitution, because it, again, is actually a translation into English of the protocols of the Iroquois Confederation, which gave justice to every man and woman as sovereign beings in this part of the world before the arrival of the Europeans. And people can get information on technology about what I've just said at phillynmc.webs.com, phillynmc.webs.com, and you can download operational procedures and concepts that deal with the concepts I've just spoken on. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Jasper, for that. And I'm going to do a time check. We have about 15 minutes left and a few presenters still in the queue. So I'm going to move along, and we can make sure we have the link, Jasper, to the email on the member page as well, so folks can look there if they want to follow up with you. So Marion Douglas Ungara, Marion, if you are ready to share about your work around the decade as well.
Yes. Hi. Hello, everybody. This is Marion in Washington, and I have a relatively new nonprofit, 501c3, called Afro Americas. This has to do with the International Decade for People of African Descent. It just sort of coincides, my creation of the NGO coincides with the beginning of this decade. I've been working on issues of Afro descendants in the Americas for at least a couple of decades, actually longer than that. So it's sort of a godsend that the decade has started as of January 1st. I attended the United Nations Human Rights Group's civil society briefing for the decade in November 19th of last year, a few months ago. And it was not a big turnout. It was an important meeting, I think, but not a large turnout. What was interesting was that the best represented group of Afro descendants were from Colombia. And I happen to know one of the folks who came, one of the Afro-Colombians. I think there were three men. They didn't all come from the same location. I think one of them is based in Spain. Another one is here in Washington, D.C., and I'm not sure about the third fellow. But they were very well organized and made good contributions. So then there was a lady from Haiti also, but she was based in Switzerland, in Geneva, a young woman, last name Joseph. And then there was an African lady from the continent, and I forget there was a one European background man, but he, I didn't get his name. I'm not sure what group he was there representing. And the commissioners themselves, or rather the working group of experts, there are five members. Working group is now chaired by Mireille Fanon Mendes France, who happens to be Frantz Fanon's daughter. For those of us who are familiar with his writing, Frantz Fanon, who was from Martinique and therefore Afro-descendant of the Americas, Black Skin, White Masks, and Wretched of the Earth were two of his books. So his daughter, Mireille Fanon Mendes France, and I, we sat down last September here in Washington with another Afro-descendant who's based in the Netherlands, Beryl Beekman, and had a good conversation. And then I saw Mireille, of course, again in Geneva in November. Another member of the commission is Vereen Shepherd, or rather the working group of experts. Professor Vereen Shepherd from Jamaica, and she was the chair of the working group before Ms. Fanon Mendes France. And it was actually Vereen Shepherd who got the United Nations General Assembly to declare the decade, formally declare the decade. And I've been in touch with Professor Shepherd for about a year, and then we met in Geneva. Then there's also Sabelo Gumadze, who is the one continental African on the working group of experts, and he is based in South Africa, but he is actually from, I forget if it was Malawi or he's from another part of Southern Africa, but he's based in South Africa. Of course, everybody's national representation has nothing to do with the working group, actually, because Mireille Mendes France, she's in France. Michel Balzerzak is in Poland. He's a new member of the commission, and Ricardo Sunga is also new. He's from Philippines. Michelle Balserzak is from Poland, and those persons I have not met. They had not taken their seats in November, but they are now on the working group of experts, and I'm not sure how the working group members are selected, because I think the Americas is underrepresented, as well as Afro-descendants in Europe, but I'm not sure about the Polish and Philippines connection. Also, Afro-descendants from the Middle East and South Asia, who are mainly the people from the Indian Ocean slave trade, nobody is really talking about them yet. I wanted to also share that the working group will have its next meeting from the end of March until, I think it's March the 30th, until April the 2nd. And I was planning to go, but now I'm not sure because of family commitments whether I'll be able to get to that meeting. It'll be the first meeting since the decade has started. Also, I wanted to mention the issue of the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, because we have that level of organization. I think it's really important, and the reason, one of the reasons that I started Afro-Americas is because we are an historic population of the Afro-descendants whose ancestors survived the transatlantic slave trade from Africa, regardless of whether we're in Paraguay or Canada or Bolivia, you know, or Aruba, wherever. And I think that we have to be recognized at that level, at the same level our countries and the region is organized. The region is organized at the inter-American level. I don't think it effectively represents especially the Afro-descendants and the indigenous people. It wasn't set up that way. But I believe that within the Pan-African context of the decade and the global African presence that people talk about, that it's absolutely valid and absolutely necessary that Afro-descendants of the Americas, we are recognized as a common population. So also my group on Facebook, which is predates the creation of my 501c3, which I did in 2013. I've had this group on Facebook for about 4 years, which now we have over 2,000 members, Afro descendants from all over the Americas. I also wanted to point out that I had an interview with Alice Backer, who is Haitian background. She's based in New York, and she has a radio program, an internet radio program every Friday night. She interviewed me on January the 16th. We talked about the decade, and we talked about Afro-Americas and related topics. I'm actually producing a transcript of that interview, which was 2 hours. Her website is Kiskeicity, KISKEACITY.com. KISKEA, and then city, CITY.com. We talked about the United Nations and the particular problems which are raised, I think, when you look at the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, people really were not prepared. I don't think that the international human rights community nor the human rights groups in the U.S. were prepared when the situation in Ferguson kind of blew up. And I want to say that my own family was enslaved in Missouri, among other places in what is now the United States. We have a lack of response. Our appeals at the international level are not new. I think I raised at our meeting in Atlanta in 2013 the report from 1951 when black Americans took a report to the United Nations. We charged genocide, the crime of government against the Negro people. And I'm still trying to find out what actually happened to that report. That was a book-length report. The book is available on the Internet. It's in print. And but as I understand it, the United Nations never formally acknowledged receiving it, even though there are photographs of the document being handed over by Paul Robeson at the UN in New York in December of 1951. So there's a lack of seriousness. There needs to be accountability to Afro descendants, in this case from the U.S., but this also has implications for other situations, such as the recent Haitian case of the United Nations peacekeepers taking cholera to Haiti and now telling the world that they're not going to be responsible. So it's problematic that we have the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, and so forth, but the same body that we're looking to acknowledge human rights abuses and also to oversee this decade for people of African descent, their own conduct is at question, and that's a very real issue.
Marion? I'm sorry. We only have about 6 minutes left, so I'm going to have to ask you to bring your presentation to a close so that we can move on in the agenda.
Okay, thanks. Let me just wrap it up by saying that another case of things not being done in terms of the human rights community and where I think the network, we really need the network to be aware and involved. The Inter-American Human Rights Commission has had a complaint since 2007 on behalf of the elderly survivors of the Tulsa, Oklahoma race riots of 1921. And those people are in their 90s and over 100 years old, and not a peep has been heard out of the Inter-American Human Rights Commission for their case. And on that note, I'll wrap it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Marion. And I do want to make sure that we connect you and Stephanie and Dewoti after we finish with a member meeting. So I'm going to move quickly now to Eric Tarz, and then just to give folks a heads up, we'll go to Angelo Pinto and then Nadia Ben Youssef and then J.R. Fleming. So if you can try to make your presentations in a minute to a minute and a half. And then also if D'Angelo Bester is on the call as well. So, Eric?
Hi, thanks. Very quickly, I just wanted to make people aware of a new report that we put out in December. It's called Human Rights to Human Reality, 10 Steps to Effective Federal human rights advocacy, and this is kind of a case study of a lot of work that we've done, as well as complementary case studies on some other members of the Human Rights at Home campaign, talking about how we have been successful in using the international mechanisms and education and grassroots efforts on education about the human rights framework to actually create policy change at the federal level. This past year, the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness created a whole website dedicated to human rights and alternatives to criminalization of homelessness, the first time a domestically focused federal agency has talked about human rights in this forthright way. Coming up this next month, we expect to see a question on a funding questionnaire from HUD about the criminalization of homelessness, which has been a major goal of our international advocacy over the past few years, and getting this question would not have happened but for the international advocacy. So many of the steps that we took to get to that point are detailed in this report, and we think it'll be very useful for folks who have been engaged in these processes and are trying to now move the international gains that they've made into their domestic policy advocacy. And I also wanted to mention that next week we will be holding a consultation as part of the UPR process with HUD, where we will be talking about housing as a human right with high-level political and career staff participation. We think we are hoping that it will overcome many of the problems that some of the other UPR consultations have seen, and we really hope that it will be a starting point for a transition to a human rights approach to housing at the federal government. So that's it for now. The report is available on our website, which is nlchp.org for National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, nlchp.org.
Thank you, Eric, for that presentation. And for those on the phone, he referred to the UPR, which is the Universal Periodic Review that's coming up early this year. And it's a review of the U.S. Government's human rights record fully, inclusive of economic, social, and cultural rights. So it'll be a culmination of the reviews that have taken place in 2014. Angelo Pinto, if you could tell us about your work with Raising the Age.
Gotcha. So this is Angelo Pinto, and I'm with an organization called the Correctional Association of New York. This past August, I was able to participate in the CERD review in Geneva. But just to give a little bit of background of what the actual issue is, so New York State is currently one of two states that automatically prosecute 16 and 17-year-olds as adults for any crime that they commit. What that means is that the 16 and 17-year-olds in New York are also automatically housed in adult jails and prisons. Last year in January, the governor of the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo, created a commission that would take a closer look at the issues of raising the age of criminal responsibility in New York and wider youth justice issues. The state of the state, a couple of weeks ago now, he announced that he would be implementing into his budget legislation and a plan to actually end that practice in New York State, along with some other comprehensive youth justice reforms, raising the bottom age of youth who could be prosecuted as old, and also keeping youth in youth facilities to the age of 21 as opposed to 18, and some other things I won't get into at this point. Additionally, just to wrap up, as a member of the Correctional Association of New York, one of the coalitions I'm a part of is a coalition called Justice League New York, who has participated and organized a number of actions around youth justice last year, and most recently this year, a number of actions around the death of Eric Garner in New York State. We had a relatively big rally on Martin Luther King Day in New York City. In the subsequent past 6 weeks, we've been able to procure meetings with the governor, the mayor, as well as the attorney general, and actually plan a big march from New York City to D.C. On April 13th, I believe. So That is just to say that we are connecting the issues of youth incarceration, mass incarceration, and policing. And just to highlight, when I was in Geneva for CERD in August, happened to be the same day or the day after Michael Brown was murdered in Ferguson, and it became a part of the conversation that happened in Geneva. So I will leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that report out, Angelo. So we are at an hour and 31 minutes, though there are a number of people still engaged with the call. So we're going to go about 5 minutes over because I do want to provide opportunity for Nadia and JR and D'Angelo to report out. But please try to keep your presentations to a minute and a half. For those of you that are still on the phone, thank you for staying engaged. So, Nadia, if you can report out on your work.
Great. Thank you so much for sticking with us till the end and for letting me be a last-minute addition to the program. And, in fact, so my name is Nadia Ben-Youssef. I'm the U.S. representative for ADNA, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. And we're investigating what a U.S. presence for our organization looks like, and much of that work is going to be about cross-movement building and taking advantage of this movement for intersectionality that was discussed at the very beginning. And one of ADNA's key focuses, and when I present our organization often to American audiences, I use the example that ADNA is like the NAACP equivalent of Israel. So we do impact litigation on behalf of the Arab minority in Israel, which is a 20% national minority. And part of our work is very much focused on systemic discrimination. And recently, throughout the course of our history on issues of police violence and state impunity. So we are looking ahead to the March session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva, and the week three of the Human Rights Council is really focused on minority rights and racial discrimination, coming off of the forum on racial discrimination, the forum on minority issues last November, which was called Preventing and Addressing Violence and Atrocity Crimes Targeted Against Minorities. And we want to raise some of these stories and cases of recent police killings in Israel of young Palestinian citizens of Israel and bring that into the global conversation now in this movement against systemic state violence against minorities. And we are looking at a side event where we'll bring different voices. We're bringing together with partners in Israel the father of a young man who was killed in November by police and wanting to see whether we can partner with members of the U.S. Human Rights Network. And I'm in touch with Benjamin, Mary, and Joshua just actually this morning. So if people are interested, if you're headed to the Human Rights Council in March, if your organizations are headed there, we're looking to have a global conversation and bring in the Special Rapporteur on minority issues, the Special Rapporteur also on the extrajudicial killings into that conversation and start forming a global response to this crisis. And my email address is Nadia, N-A-D-I-A, at adala.org. And it's a bit urgent because requests for side events are due on February 2nd, which is next week. But if it's something that you're interested in or if you're going to be there, I'd be happy to hear about it. And thank you all so much for this inspiring conversation. It's been a pleasure to listen.
Thank you, Nadia, for that report out. J.R. Fleming, J.R., do you want to report out on the Land and Housing Member-Initiated Action Team? J.R.? JR, are you there? Okay, I think
he's still there.
Yeah, I think he's not there. So let's have D'Angelo Bester. D'Angelo?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Hey, how is everyone doing today? Again, my name is D'Angelo Bester. I'm with the organization called the Workers Center for Racial Justice. We're here in Chicago, in Illinois. We organize unemployed, low-wage, and former incarcerated black workers around, you know, basic racial and economic justice issues. The majority of our work is centered around that intersection between labor and incarceration and criminalization. And so, you know, about two-thirds of our members are all ex-offenders. So criminalization has really been a big part of the work that we currently do. And just, you know, I'll be brief, but, you know, we in Chicago, there's an election coming up to decide who our new mayor is going to be. And one of the biggest issues in Chicago has been kind of violence in the community, and even more important, the violence perpetrated on the black community by the police and stuff like that. And so we are organizing a big mayoral candidates forum to really push all of the mayoral candidates to think about what their policies are going to be moving forward to address the issue of police violence against black folks here in Chicago and police harassment and profiling and intimidation. And so we're doing this forum specifically around the issue of criminalization and police accountability. It's going to be the only forum of its kind for the mayoral race, which is coming up in February. And, that's basically the main thing that we're working on now. We're a new organization, less than 3 years old, so all of our capacity is really moving into this area of work around holding our city officials accountable for the actions of police officers here.
Thank you, D'Angelo. It looks like JR's popped back on the phone, Yolande.
Okay.
JR?
Yeah. Dead zone. Just real quick. The member-initiated action team, land housing, and action group will be taking on a big task this year around the 10th year commemoration of Hurricane Katrina, at which time we're going to be having a land housing and a human right to housing and land summit. Throughout the course of this year, we're going to be doing a residence report as it pertains to uploading video of homeless person, public housing residents, tenants, and homeowners who are facing the housing crisis. In addition to that, we'll be participating locally and nationally in the roundtable. Thanks to Eric and National Law Center for helping to coordinate that around UPR with HUD. Some of the great things that have happened for us thus far, though, is we've been able to move the Federal Housing Finance Authority in a progressive direction. So there's a lot of groups in Chicago who are now going to be receiving a lot of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac properties, and so we're trying to make sure these properties end up in the hand of groups and housing groups that have an emphasis on the human rights to housing. We're going to be emphasizing a lot around community-controlled housing, which entails community land trust. And so I just tell folks, stay tuned. There's a lot of great things coming out in the housing movement.
Okay. Thank you, JR. And thank you to everybody that shared on the call today. And for those of you that have stayed on the call the entire time, we apologize that we went about 10 minutes over. We were going to talk a little bit about the UPR work, but I think we're going to have to end the call. If you are interested in learning more about the UPR work or getting involved with it, I encourage you to send an email to upr@ushrnetwork.org, upr@ushrnetwork.org. And my colleagues, Tenjiwe McHarris and Mary Goresh, Mary with the Vermont Worker Center, are the folks most engaged with that work. So you could also reach out to Tenjiwe at the Coordinating Center, and she can connect you with Mary. The other announcement Yolande mentioned at the beginning of the call, for those of you who may be joined during the call, we hope you've seen the announcement that the biennial conference will be in Austin, Texas this year, December the 11th through the 13th. We sent out a save the date, and we'll start rolling out more information in February and March, including calls for proposals. And we will be constructing, you know, the web page. where and we'll send out a notice about that so people can start going to that to keep up with the conference planning. So thank you to everyone that presented. Like the October call, it's just amazing the work that folks are doing, the diversity of the work, the advocacy, the activism, and we're just very, very happy and pleased that that we're all doing this work together and that the Coordinating Center is able to support it in the ways that we can. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'll send out the announcement for the next member call, and we ask you to reach out to your peers, colleagues, friends, let them know about it, and encourage them to join as well. Thanks so much. We'll end the call now.